When Gail Bell was 10 years old, her dad showed her this beautiful old-fashioned wooden sample case. When it was flipped open, Gail saw a neat row of little glass bottles with rubber stoppers and handwritten labels. Gail took out one of the bottles and she took a sniff. And then her dad snatched the bottle away from her and said, "Never, never do that. You could die." She asked what was in the bottle and her dad said, "Poison." The case had belonged to Gail's grandfather, a man named Dr. William Macbeth. Dr. William Macbeth was a travelling showman and healer with a lurid reputation in the family folklore because it was said that in the 1920s, William Macbeth had poisoned his two eldest sons and got off scot-free. Decades later, his granddaughter Gail, who never knew him, became a chemist and an author, and she wondered if the family's story was true. The result was a classic book published to international acclaim in 2001, called The Poison Principle, which is full of the science and the stories behind strychnine, arsenic, wolfsbane, belladonna, those toxic names that still hold a creepy, gothic fascination. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Richard.
How pretty were those glass bottles you saw in that sample?
They were lovely, and I've seen many versions of them in my years as a chemist. Lovely shapes, lovely colours, beautiful labels. Often in copper plate handwriting, the labels in copper plate handwriting.
What kind of substances? Were they always like sludgy?
Sludgy, icky stuff on the bottom. I mean, it's a memory from a long time ago, the original one that you're talking about, the one mm-hmm. that Dad showed me. It was just sludge on the bottom and a little bit of sticky stuff on the side.
And when you took a sniff, what did it smell like? Do you remember?
The one I smelt was quite acidic. It could have been decomposed, but yeah, it was just, I was thinking perfume at that age. I wasn't thinking poison.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it foul?
Or? Yeah, yeah. Yes, it was. It was one of those instinctive smells that tell you that there's something not right about it.
Right, don't drink me, in other words.
Don't drink me.
It brings to mind Alice in Wonderland, that drink me potion that's there that might shrink you or make you incredibly tall. The family folklore story, back in 1980, or way back in 1980, you met with your great aunt Rose, and I think this was the only time you wrote that you actually got to meet with her and talk with her before she died. Now, tell me the story that she told you about how she and her sister, who became your grandmother, met Dr. William Macbeth.
Well, my aunt Rose was an interesting character. She carried a lot in her expressions and features. She carried a lot of bitterness, and I saw that straight off. She really didn't want to talk to me, but she did. She agreed. The story that I got was that the two sisters, that was a large family, there were quite a few sisters in the family, lived in rural New South Wales where not much went on and where entertainment was hard to come by. And in Orange, in New South Wales, was advertised a faith healing evening with Dr. William Macbeth, and posters showing this very glamorous man, top hat, silver-topped cane, frock coat.
Oh, wow, really? The whole thing, was it?
The whole Mandrake the Magician thing.
And this is like the 1920s, is it?
This is the 1920s. In fact, it was 1922. And they went, and he asked people to form a circle, and he walked around the circle touching people, asking them not to tell their story, but simply divining what was wrong with them. So putting his hand on the head or the shoulder or the arm and picking it up. Rose, I think, was pretty struck by him right from the beginning. And she was, I think, hoping that he would get up close and personal with her. He did. He helped her with her asthma. But he locked eyes with her younger and prettier sister, Ellen, who was just 18, straight off the farm, ready for anything, who fell madly in love with Dr. Macbeth. And in fact, if my putting together of the dates works out, I think they got together that night.
Wow.
Rose and William. If you look at the date of the tour and the date on the birth certificate of their first child. Now, she was only 18. Rose was considerably older. They married because Ellen was pregnant and Rose was pushed aside.
So they had eventually had four kids.
Four sons in 5 years.
Now, he also sold a tonic. Tell me about this tonic that Dr. William Macbeth sold at these fake
healing
exhibitions.
Well, if you're going to be a good quack, you've got to have a good line in potions and lotions, and you can fix anything with it, from warts to cancer.
To lack of virility in the gentleman as well, perhaps.
Yes, well, that
inability
came,
to perform the marital duty.
Exactly, and that came later, and that was his undoing, really. I think for the purposes of his first country tour, he was doing the usual quack number of, you know, I can cure anything with this green mixture or this red mixture or this brown mixture or by touching you with my hands.
So that's what he sold. And then, well, like I said, they had four sons. Tell me what was wrong, though, with the first son that was born, Thomas.
As I found out, Ellen was barely 19 when the first son was born, at home with no medical assistance, umbilical cord wrapped around the neck, severe depletion of oxygen to the brain, and very severe
brain damage
and defects. They tried to keep him at home. They tried to care for him at home as three other sons came in quick succession.
So they would have been under very strained circumstances.
Very strained circumstances. And by then we're heading towards the Great Depression. They're in Katoomba in the Blue Mountains of Sydney. And
he's stuck with kids and he probably likes to be on the road.
Oh, yeah. He liked to be on the road. He liked to be with people. He liked an audience.
Right. And probably liked to meet other Ellens along the way, too.
I'm guessing that as well. Rose tried to insert herself into their life by helping him make his potions at home in the kitchen because Ellen was too busy with the other boys. So she got involved with the grinding and the mixing and the sticking the corks in the bottle and helping him to label, being his right-hand girl, if you like.
His sorcerer's apprentice. So there's four sons at home, and the oldest has got severe brain damage and needs constant round-the-clock care. What story did Rose tell you about the death of the two oldest sons?
Okay, so there's Thomas with the brain damage, and then there's Patrick. And
he's perfectly healthy.
He's perfectly healthy, lovely little boy, 3 years old. Rose told me at that interview that William had developed a tonic for men's virility called Macbeth's Strengthening Tonic for Men Only that contained strychnine. He'd been reading journals from overseas that said that strychnine increased virility. And he wasn't quite sure of the dosages, and so she told me that he experimented on his two eldest sons, in a sense implying that Thomas, the crippled boy, was disposable, really, and that Patrick was, well, he was a little troublemaker, he was noisy, he upset the rhythm and the quietness that William needed to make his tonics. And I was horrified. I wrote this story down, I recorded it on tape recorder, I wrote it down, and I was horrified, as my father was horrified, because this was the received story in the family.
Right. And so there would have been great silences around this, I suppose.
Oh, yes.
Terrible silences and pain and all those things. So once you'd heard this story, how did she say that the three-year-old boy, Patrick, had died? What were the circumstances of his death?
She said that he died at the family home. She was vague about Thomas. She said that he died in Katoomba in the family home and that William was called to account, but that he got away with it, and that he got away with it because he was a smooth talker.
Once the two boys were dead, the two older sons, there were still two more younger sons, including your dad.
Mm.
What did Ellen do then after the death of the two boys?
She left him. She left him, and she went to live with Rose. So Rose then becomes the person who has the story. Rose owns the story then. Ellen's voice goes very quiet. Not that there is much to find of her voice, but she goes quiet.
How long did Ellen last for before she died?
She died very young, 33. And I think it was put down to a blood clot to the heart. I suspect she had toxemia because she was pregnant to her second husband.
Once you heard this story from Rose, once you thought about it for a while, you said you became a bit sceptical about it. It didn't quite ring true. What was it about it that bothered you, this story from Rose?
Oh, I just couldn't imagine a father experimenting on his own sons. I just couldn't imagine it. And I couldn't imagine the man who was my father's father. My father was a very gentle man who loved children, who was open and honest about everything in his life. And I couldn't imagine... And that's a daughter's projection onto a father she loved, because I'm sure there have been murdering fathers out there.
I suppose so, but I don't know if I've ever heard a story like that before.
No.
That seems a bit like right out of the box, doesn't it? That the
it
father
does,
experimenting on his sons.
It smacked of something other. It smacked of score settling to me.
Right. So when you contacted, after Rose died, you contacted your auntie Betty, a younger sister of Rose's. What did she tell you about the kind of triangle of your grandfather, your grandmother, and Rose?
Oh, she put it straight into context.
Did she?
She said, you know, Rose was in love with William. There's no doubt about it. She fancied him from minute one. She'd had a lot of bad luck in her life, and he overlooked her and went straight to her prettier younger sister, and she never really got over that.
It was some time before you found out the real story about what actually happened to him. We'll come to that soon, but I want to talk to you about the poison that was said to have killed these boys, strychnine, that was put in this solution to improve men's virility. Where does strychnine come from? What's its origin?
It comes from a plant. It comes from the fruit of a tree that grows in tropical climates. There are seeds inside the fruit. And it's a very toxic poison. It's a nerve poison. It attacks the nervous system, and it has some pretty ghastly consequences.
Yeah, what does a lethal dose look like when someone dies from strychnine poisoning?
Well, the nervous system goes into overdrive, and nerves are connected to muscles. Muscles cramp up. Initially, with strychnine overdose, they all cramp up together, but then it goes out of sync, so you've got certain muscles contracting and others relaxing, so there's this sort of spasming going on.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's pretty ghastly. What's even more awful to contemplate is that it's a central nervous system stimulant, so it's also working in a different way inside the brain, causing this hyper-awareness of the senses.
All right, so you're not being knocked out. You're more aware of what's going on as
more.
You're dying.
Yes.
From this sort of thing.
You're sort of locked in to this body that's
spasming.
And
so what happens? Obviously, the back arch and do all that,
yes,
does it?
Yes, the back arches, and in fact, in severe cases, you can have the feet on the floor, the head on the floor, and the body arched up, and then you get this rictus grin.
You see, now when I read that was interesting to me, because I don't know if you're aware of this, Gail, but when I was a kid, I had a reprint of the very first edition of Batman comics from 1940, where the Joker makes his first appearance. And it's not the camp Joker of the TV series, who's, you know, colourful and a bit of a ne'er-do-well. This is a really monstrous creature, the first Joker, when he appears. It's the first image of him. He's got this full face, he's white-faced, bloodshot eyes, and he's a poisoner. Joker has this Joker drug, which he gives to his victims in the form of a gas or an injection. It makes them flail about and spasm, their backs arch, and they die with this hideous rictus grin on their faces. That sounds a lot like strychnine,
doesn't
it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it does.
Oh, that is so damn creepy, that is. You've got a story in your book about when you were a chemist and a little boy took something. Tell me about that.
Yes, I was a young chemist then, and there was a product on the market, I don't know if anyone will remember it, called Allafin tablets, and they had a chocolate covering.
What was it? What kind of a drug was it? A laxative or something?
It was a laxative, right. Yeah, basically. And Mum was busy at the counter, and the little boy I was the baby chemist over here, the main man was there, and she was talking to him, but I had my eyes on the little boy, and he'd taken the bottle of Allafin off, and it didn't have childproof lids in those days. He'd taken them off, seen a whole bunch of chocolate-coloured lollies, and he wolfed the whole lot down. And luckily, taking so much, he then vomited very rapidly, and I later found out this is what saved his life. He'd just had an ice cream which had coated his stomach. So there was this pool of vomit with these little brown stains in them. And I don't know, just instinctively, I got down on my hands and knees and I counted the little brown stains to make sure that none of them had got further than his stomach down to the bottom.
And in each of these little pellets was the tiniest fragment of
strychnine. Tiniest fragment, but if you added all of them up, every tablet in that bottle, he would have died.
Gee, Gail, the 70s were a different era, weren't they? I mean, you put strychnine with chocolate coating in a bottle with a tamper-proof seal on it. We lived dangerously in those days, didn't we?
We did, but we survived.
Yeah, so was the little boy all right?
Yeah, he was fine. He got into big trouble from Mum.
Ryan, I bet that's part of his family folklore now too. Did your decision to become a chemist, study pharmacy, have anything to do with your grandfather?
None at all. I was born after he died, but the interest had been there. In science class, actually, at school, it all began back in school, and I was friends with a couple of girls who, because I bailed out of school early and went on and did other things and then came back and did my degree when I was 21. And I rang these girls up and said, what did you do? Because I was thinking maybe of medicine. And they said, oh, we did pharmacy. And I thought, oh, that sounds all right. If they can do it, I can do it.
Right. It was just on the basis of that, right?
Yeah, simple as that.
And she wrote about this stuff really in a kind of a loving sort of way. It's a funny thing. So clearly the job really appealed to you.
Oh, then. Yes. Mostly working in hospitals I loved the most.
Tell me about the unhappy chemist who trained you, Gail.
Yes,
he was an unhappy man.
I don't know what he was unhappy about, but he certainly didn't like me. And I tried very hard because I needed, you had to do a sort of internship of 12 months with a master pharmacist, master chemist, and be ticked off in order to get your papers. And he mostly ignored me, but when he did speak to me, he spoke in Latin because he considered that any well-bred pharmacist was conversant in Latin. And I knew the Latin abbreviations for take one three times a day or apply the cream, but I did not know.
Is this a private school thing versus a state school thing? Is that what it was?
It quite possibly was.
Right. So this was designed to intimidate you. And there you are working in a pharmacy surrounded by all kinds of poisons in little bottles on shelves. Did you entertain revenge fantasies at all?
I got heavily into revenge fantasies with him, and I later discovered that Agatha Christie did the same thing.
Really? Was she a chemist?
Well, during the war, she took a job in a hospital and worked in the pharmacy. That's where she got all her material for all her poison stories. And she had a pharmacist who kept a ball of pure curare in his pocket. And he said to her, she questioned him one day, and he said, "It makes me feel powerful."
Wow. What, really had a lump of poison in his pocket? Oh, that's creepy, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're always going into the realm of the gothic here with poisons. It seems to me like, and maybe it has seemed to you as well, you became a chemist without knowing about your grandfather's story. Then you find out about your grandfather's story, and you're also an author. I know this sounds a bit silly, but does it seem like you were, something was I don't know, preparing or grooming you to tell this story about your grandfather?
I've come to believe that that's true. I've come to believe that we become aware, hyper aware of things that are vital to the person we are, and I often felt in the research and writing of this book that, not exactly that I was channeling William, but that I had some sort of affinity with him, some sort of connection that went beyond the records that I found and the people that I spoke to. There was something, some reason that I'd come along.
At one point, you say you went to see a psychometric reader and you took along William's handkerchief box with you. This isn't a hugely scientific way about to go about your research as a person of science, is it? But you went anyway for fun.
Well, I like to sit on the divide on that edge between science and magic. And I was not, the pieces would not fit. Why would he do this? What was it all about? And I knew that psychometric readers could take articles belonging to people and pick up vibrations. And I'd inherited a lot of, and that's another interesting thing, why was I the one to inherit William's things, all his monogrammed this and all his fake business cards that he had. And the psychometric reader said that he picked up the great love that William had for Ellen, even though things went wrong.
Yes. He also, the psychometric reader said, the owner of this box has something to tell you. Look for the answer in the mixing.
In the mixing, yes. Yes.
Did that keep you going for a bit longer?
That kept me going for a long time. And I love puzzles like that. And I love little hinting messages like that. So I did go looking for the answer in the mixing, as it turns out.
The culture often shows poisoning as being women's work. It's a very different kind of murder to a crime of passion, where typically performed by a man, where there's an act of great violence and there's often blood spilled or something. Poisoning has traditionally been seen, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly actually, but rightly or wrongly, as women's work. Is there something, there's something kind of perverse about all this too, isn't there? The role of the woman as a poisoner.
Yes, there is, because it strikes right at the heart and hearth. Women traditionally make the food, they serve the food, they recommend the food. You've got an upset stomach, I'll make you some chicken soup with a bit of arsenic in it.
They nurse the ill, yes, that's
yes,
right.
Yes, they do all of that. And it's a sinister act.
What, an abuse of trust?
It is an abuse of trust, definitely. And women were very good at it. But there were also men poisoners, but they didn't employ the same methods. They had perhaps the same motive and opportunity, but not the same methods as women.
There is that kind of argument that goes back and forth, which is typically in murder cases, the perpetrator is nearly, 95%, 99%, I don't know, is male rather than female. But the counter-argument is women are better at not getting caught.
That's right. That's right.
What do you think of all that anyway? I mean, what do you suppose? We're just talking in the realm of supposition here, aren't we?
When I'm entertaining revenge fantasies myself, I factor in the fact that I think I could get away with it.
There is something seen as, like, I suppose that's the thing about the way these things take place, is that there's malice there, but it's very cold-blooded. Is it always murder and not manslaughter when it comes to poisoning, pretty much?
Well, yes, it has to be. The definition makes it murder, because it's malice aforethought. It planning goes into it. I just don't decide to poison you right now without having baked the muffins and
just the poison,
and got you into a comfortable position and handed them over.
You're really scaring me now, Gail.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online. All our conversations are available on the ABC Radio app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
One story you've got in there is a story of, probably fictional, of Cleopatra. She wanting to die, wanting to commit suicide with poison, but in such a way that it would leave an immaculate corpse.
Yes.
She didn't want to be found by Augustus, doubled up with a kind of an awful grin on her face, blue and foaming at the mouth, with, you know, stuff coming out of her from every orifice, did she?
So, no. And this is quite common in suicides, not wanting to be found as an ugly corpse. I read quite a few books on Cleopatra and discovered one author who had looked into the different experiments, in fact, that she performed or had performed on slaves. So show me this poison, show me how it works. No, his mouth turned blue, I don't want that. Show me that poison, no, he's having a fit, I don't want that.
God!
And so these poor slaves lined up. all being dosed with poison.
Gee, the one next one in the queue would be hoping that this one would finally please the Queen, wouldn't they?
Well, yes. If they drop dead nicely, yes. Yeah,
that's right. Please have a pleasant death for my sake. But just how hard is it to find that poison? It seems like it's nearly impossible.
It's almost impossible. It is almost impossible, and it is a fiction writer's job really to find the poison that works in that way because in the real world all of them have ghastly effects.
Like in Shakespeare, when someone takes poison and just drops sighs and falls to the ground, that's not what happens, is it?
No. And the body, luckily, we're born with a body that knows how to defend itself. So it's trying to get rid of that poison. It's trying to make you vomit, make you sweat.
Right, it violently rebels.
And rebels. Yeah. It rebels. Yeah. Get this thing out of me. Get it out.
This reminded me of a story I knew from reading Kenneth Anger's book, Hollywood Babylon, from years ago. I don't know if you know this story, about the Hollywood actress Lupe Velez. She was born in Mexico. Career went on the skids. Unhappy life. Had a big dinner. She served this beautiful Mexican food and announced that she was going to take an overdose and kill herself. And so she took an overdose of, so the urban legend goes, took an overdose of Seconal
pill? Yes.
Yeah, pills as they were back then, sleeping tablets, an overdose.
Arbiturate, yeah.
Lay down on a bed of roses so she'd be discovered in this beautiful Hollywood dress. But of course, the Mexican food rebelled. It all came up. And she staggered towards the toilet and was found drowned in the toilet, essentially. And that wasn't quite the immaculate death she was looking for, Gail.
Exactly. And this is the foresight of Cleopatra, if it's true, is that she had her attendants ready so that when she chose the snake option, she'd watched a few snake bite deaths and thought, I can do that, but there will be froth coming out of my mouth and my eyes might be rolled back. And so her attendants were instructed to clean her up and do the very thing that
Lupe Velez wanted
done, and then lay her out and then die themselves.
Right, so she'd be found by the Roman emperor lying there looking immaculate, in queenly regalia.
Fit for a queen.
Arsenic, famous poison, hugely so. It appears in popular culture of the 19th century all over the place. Where does that come from?
It's an element. It's a pure substance element.
Is it a metal or something? Or?
Well, yes, it's found in the Earth's crust, element 33. It's a sort of greyish powder. It happily marries with other compounds and forms any number of compounds. White arsenic was very common all over the world, available in pharmacies for getting rid of vermin and bed bugs in the home. You could go in and buy your half ounce and take it home, and as long as you signed the register.
You've got a story of it being used as a kind of a dye, and there's a great story in your book about a woman who attended a ball in a green dress. Please tell me that story. I just love that story. Well, I don't know if I love it, but it's fascinating nonetheless.
Well, it was 1862, London ballroom season, and ladies wanting to be seen at their very best, ladies who could afford silk in silk, ladies who couldn't in tarlatan, which was an open weave fabric, which took up dye very well. And in Germany, they had a dye made from a combination of arsenic and copper, which wasn't well known in the community. They put this dye on the tarlatan, worked on it, and you could get a very beautiful ball gown out of it. It was also used in other products as well.
Well, like a metallic green. That kind
yes,
of thing,
lovely,
right?
Shiny green. So this particular lady, very young girl, not quite 20, fully dressed in that elaborate gown with the crinolines, you know, so it was that bustle thing out the back, and matching headdress and gloves and the whole thing, had enough arsenic on board basically to kill everybody in the room, because the paste is sitting on top of the fabric. So you imagine a crowded ballroom, people swirling around, dancing, admiring her dress, and meanwhile these lethal green particles are wafting. Now, she danced until about midnight when she started to get terrible gastric pains, and this is what happens with arsenic. It sort of shreds your intestinal tract as it goes down. she was taken away. A doctor saw her, and they knew arsenic, but they didn't make the connection. So they were thinking cholera, because there were a lot of young soldiers there back from the east in London. She was taken to the infectious hospital around the corner, and she died at 3 a.m. from her ball gown,
oh,
basically.
Oh, God. Yeah. And if you think about it, that a ballroom is hot. Mm. She has constant movement. The fabric is swishing all the time. And there's fans and all this cloud of evil green particles floating through this ballroom. What were they doing making a ball gown out of this stuff?
Well, it wasn't only ball gowns. They lined boots with it, and men died from arsenic poisoning coming out of the lining of their boots. It was a long time before this sort of evil, if you like, this public evil was identified, and women were told when they went shopping for fabrics to carry a little vial which they would touch on the fabric, and if it turned a particular colour, it told you that the that arsenic was present.
So, right, ladies, before buying a dress, test it for arsenic, will you? Right. Like I said, you've been a chemist's assistant. Please tell me the story about the young man in a British chemist shop who tried to woo a female co-worker with an aphrodisiac, called Spanish Fly. Now, I knew, the folklore of Spanish Fly as an aphrodisiac is pretty reasonably well known, but it's a poison? I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. It comes from the blister beetle. It's a contact poison, and the theory is that it inflames the skin and inflames...
Oh, okay. The things that need to be inflamed.
The things that need to be inflamed.
Right.
But this young boy worked in Boots Chemist in London in the 60s, and he fancied one of the shop girls, but he was awkward and he couldn't quite get his moves on. So he asked the senior chemist about cantharidin, which is its chemical name, and the chemist said, it's up there, but, you know, you're not to touch that. When the chemist was on his lunch break, he took some cantharidin, bought some coconut ice, put it into two slices. He bought eight pieces, put it into two, invited the chemist girls to afternoon tea, and one piece was meant for her and one piece was meant for him. And he imagined, God knows, in a public place, that they would both be inflamed by lust and fall into each other's arms. And the whole thing went totally wrong, because one of the other girls said, oh, that looks nice, and grabbed the coconut ice and ate it. The intended ate her piece. He's standing there gawking, oh, my God, what's happening now? And within, I think, 12 hours, both those women were dead in the most horrible, horrifying way.
How did it kill them?
Well, because it's a blistering agent, it blisters all the way down. So they actually, in a sense, drowned in their own blood. And as it goes down further through the body, through the organs, they're just all destroyed by this blistering agent. Because
he
got the pure stuff, not the stuff they sell in sex shops that say, you know, it's not cantharidin. Don't be fooled.
No, that wretched man. I wonder what happened to him in the end.
Oh, he got a very light sentence,
right.
5 years.
Oh. Cyanide. I was once taken to an open-cut gold mine in northwest Australia, and part of the tour was showing me this gigantic pond of cyanide. It was heavily fenced, of course, and I went, that can't be good. I mean, it's used to rinse gold or something like that?
Yeah,
gold ore.
It's used in the gold extraction process, and I found one story set in the gold mines where a guy was accused of murder, or he was accused of something in a trial, and he asked if he could smoke one cigarette before he was sent down, and he kept the cyanide, wrapped it up in his tobacco, smoked it, and dropped dead in the court.
Oh, my God.
Pretty dramatic.
Right, with cyanide gas everywhere.
Yeah.
Right, everyone...
Yeah, everyone bolted.
Right, bolted. Now, this comes from apricot stones or peach stones?
Yes, that's
like that?
one of the sources of it, and it's a poison that robs your blood of oxygen, and that's why in poison stories, if you get the blue around the lips, and at post-mortem, the purple blood and the smell of almonds, that's all from cyanide. And, of course, it was used in America up until, I think, the 50s in
executions. Right.
Yeah.
Isn't that what Hitler and Eva Braun took before they...
Yes, the capsules they crunched. Right. In fact, I watched Downfall again the other night, and where it's actually replayed. Most people in the Second World War with money and connections had that little capsule that you crunched, and it's a very quick death. But
and there's that ghastly scene where Frau Goebbels gives it to their children. Oh, that's just almost unwatchable, isn't it, that scene?
It's horrible. I only saw it a couple of nights ago.
I had to walk out of the room in that scene, actually. It's awful.
It's horrible.
Yeah. You've got a story in your book about a school teacher who was poisoned inadvertently and killed by water from a well that was made with bricks that had accidentally been poisoned. Nonetheless, even after the investigation was conducted and this was found to have been an accidental death, people still insisted it was probably the farmer next door. Is there something about poisoning, Gail, that always wants to see malice rather than an accident, even when an accident has actually happened?
It does, and maybe it goes back to the stories that we're even told when we were young, the Wicked Witch stories.
Snow White,
the poisoned apple. It's not a cut-and-dried thing.
Yeah, so it's something that appears in the culture all the time. It's there in Sleeping Beauty as well.
It's in Sleeping Beauty, yes. And in the case of the young schoolteacher, she was boarding in a vineyard, and there were two vignerons, you know, two properties near each other, and they were jealous of each other. So the story was circulated that it was the other owner of the vineyard who had poisoned the well, because the family itself had been getting sick for a long time before this girl came to board with them, and they didn't know what it was, gastric upsets. They went away on holidays. And
yeah, so this is the warring thing in your own book, the power of science and then the power of story. Yes.
Yeah.
Always at loggerheads with one another.
Yes.
Which brings us back to your grandfather,
yes,
Dr. William Macbeth. Did your father have any memories of him?
Only one clear one. When he was about 6 or 7, perhaps a little older, his father appeared at the front door. Well, no, his father's chauffeur appeared at the front door, because William Macbeth by this stage had become a very rich man.
How had he done that?
Well, he'd been sent to a facility attached to a hospital to dry out from alcohol. And while he was in there, his impersonating self saw an opportunity, because there was a Scotsman in there, a very wealthy Scotsman, who was delusional. And William cozied up to him and managed to convince him that he was actually a visiting psychiatrist, and he could sign him out if, you know, things went his way. And he ended up with William, and he did get him out. They got out at the same time. And this man, I've got letters from this man to my grandfather. You know, he calls him my brother and so on. He gave him money, huge amount of money. We're talking the 1930s here, Depression era, the Great Depression, I mean. So he had a Rolls or some big posh car. He had a chauffeur. He had 25 suits, he had girlfriends, he had the whole lot.
So he went through the money by the sound of things then.
Oh, yeah, he went through it, yeah, and he died of tuberculosis at 48 in poverty. But this day, with my dad, he turned up at Rose's house, where Ellen was staying, and he was going to take the boys out for a spin in the car and leave Ellen some money. And Dad just remembers he'd never seen anything like it, and this man was totally unknown to him, really, but he still remembers the sartorial splendour. He still remembers the clothes, the smell of the car, the chauffeur, the leather seats.
Does he remember what his mother thought of surrendering him to the clutches of this man?
Yes, he does. He remembers that both Ellen and Rose were waiting out the front. It was only meant to be a spin around the block. And Rose was there with her hand out for the money. And they were questioned, did he do anything? Did he say anything? Are you all right? Did anything happen to you on that trip? And to a young boy, that sort of was terrifying message.
In the end, just at the last minute, the solution came to you. It sort of dropped into your hand through several documents. The solution, it seems, lay not so much in information, but in an absence of information surrounding the death of the firstborn son, Thomas, the one who'd been born brain damaged.
Yes.
Tell me what you were able to find out.
Well, I discovered that he had been institutionalised at the age of 4 or 5, taken to Newcastle, north of Sydney, and surrendered under the Lunacy Act.
So he hadn't died of poisoning at all?
No, he hadn't. And how strange is that, to allow a story to live in that moment and then to carry on through generations, that it was better that he died at the hands of his father than we handed him over to an asylum. I found that so difficult to get my head around.
How long did he last at that asylum?
He was in Newcastle for a number of years. He was very severely handicapped and he couldn't speak. He never spoke. And then he was transferred to what was called Rabbit Island, but we know as Pete Island now, where he died at the age of 12. And the records showed that he was 3 pounds heavier than when he entered the asylum in all those years that he was in there, poor little fellow.
So he hadn't been poisoned at all?
No, he hadn't been poisoned.
But Patrick, the healthy young boy who died at the age of 3, had been poisoned, Gail. He had been poisoned. But been poisoned or taken poison? Or what do you surmise really happened there?
Well, I have a number of working theories. At the coroner's inquest, poison was definitely on the table. He had died from strychnine poisoning. And it took me back to that little boy in the shop
who took the
elephant pills. So the story was that Ellen had given birth to her fourth child, my father. He was 10 days old. She was weak. She'd gone to the chemist and got a tonic, a strengthening tonic, and that she'd left it on the bedside table and young Patrick had drunk it. Now, I thought, why would they go to the chemist when they had William in the house with his little laboratory out the back making his own potions? Possibly by then Ellen didn't trust him at all. She'd rather go to the legitimate source. I suspect that, I don't think it was deliberate. I think that an inquisitive little boy went into Dad's room. He'd been watching, and I think he saw this brightly coloured liquid, and I think he took some.
Oh, dear. So it's not a crime. It's just a double tragedy.
It's a double tragedy. And I think the real poison in the story are the lies.
Bloody Aunt Rose. Aunt Rose. Why? She would have known the truth.
Mm.
So why does she tell you a lie?
I still think it was score settling. I still think over 80 years old, she was still bitter. Life had made her bitter, and somehow or other, I don't know, I look like my dad. My dad looked like his father. Maybe there was something in meeting me. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, Dr. William Macbeth, doctor indeed, was a scoundrel and a charlatan. Maybe she just thought she'd, you know, if there'd been negligence or something or whatever blame anyone might want to lump on anyone, she thought, well, she'd take it off her sister and put it on him. Maybe that was it, Gail. What do you think?
Now, there's an idea. That is an idea.
Because no one was going to criticise him for his real bad behaviour, were they?
No.
I mean, he absconded.
No. He was much liked, actually. I met people in the country when I went chasing him. People who remembered him, loved him. He cured my arthritis on the bar.
What do you make of that, anyway? I mean, people thought they had been cured, I suppose, didn't they?
Yeah. His healing hands. People were attracted to him. He was charismatic.
Your dad was once discovered in a pub once, but tell me about that.
Well, Dad was really an unwanted child after his mother died and depression, people couldn't look after him. So he took off to the country looking for his mother's people, trying to find someone to care for him, really.
How old was he when he was doing this?
14.
Oh, my God.
He hopped a freight train sort of thing, got up to Wellington, and he came into town, or the owner of the farm that he was working on came into town, left him there, went off to do something, and Dad was exploring, and this man said, "You are the spit of Dr. William Macbeth, who practiced in this town." And Dad sort of reeled back because he had all these negative feelings about his father, and to be told that he resembled him so much physically, he couldn't take it in.
And did this man know he was his son?
No.
No idea.
And Dad didn't own up to it either. He just took the message in and thought, and I don't know what went through his mind.
How was your dad when you presented all this evidence to him?
He didn't want to know, and I don't blame him, really. I presented it in folders, in pages, set it all out for him.
Like a coroner's report.
Coroner's report. Mm. But also his mother's handwriting. His mother wrote to the asylum often, "Please tell me how my son is." And the superintendent typed his response on the back, "He's doing well," or "He's doing poorly," or whatever. And I thought, Dad lost his mother when he was 10, and he never really got over that till the day he died. He loved his mother. And I thought I was giving him something back. But he explained to me that he'd constructed stories in his head, and he would rather leave them like that.
What an extraordinary tale. I really enjoyed this book so much in a really dark and gothic kind of way. It's an absolute Australian classic. Congratulations on it, and it's been such a pleasure speaking with you, Gail. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Gail Bell's book, The Poison Principle, originally published in 2001, and it's just been reissued. We'll put the details up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website, abc.net.au/conversations.